Bob Schieffer is the author of a new book, Overload, Finding Truth in Today's Deluge of News. Bob Schieffer, welcome.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here and back in Albany.
I'm old enough to remember the time when there was a morning paper, an afternoon paper. We had local news at 6 and 11, 30 minutes of network news at 6:30, Walter Cronkite, Huntley Brinkley. Were we better served as citizens and news consumers back then than we are now with a 24-hour news cycle? Is more news necessarily better news?
No, I think we were better served. And here's why. When you had three television stations in every town and a local newspaper that was probably a pretty good newspaper, we were all basing our opinions on the same facts, what we got from those basically four sources. Mm-hmm. So our opinions grew out of common data. Now we're so overwhelmed with news and information, not necessarily news, from so many different sources that the people who listen or read this particular source and the ones that listen or read another particular source are getting their own sets of facts. So one of the reasons that I think we have this great divide now in the country, we're no longer basing our opinions on common data. We're basing it on separate data, different sets of facts, and I think that's one of the problems we have now. So the question is, and the question I tried to address in this book, we get more information now than any people in the history of the world. We have more access to more. Yet, are we wiser, or are we simply just overwhelmed by so much information we can't process it? And I'm afraid we're just overwhelmed right now.
Yeah, because I never thought I was missing anything when we had Walter Cronkite, Huntley Brinkley. I think that was enough. I never felt that we were in a void of any kind.
Yeah, and the only competition they had at that time was each other.
Right.
You know, there was nothing but news on television at that time because we were still under the equal time ruling and all of that. And so the broadcast networks built these tremendous audiences because they really had no competition. Then when cable came along, there was competition, and not just news.
Mm-hmm.
There was also entertainment, and so there was competition there. And people always choose entertainment over news. So that's when the network ratings began to go down. They've never been what they were in those days.
Almost 54 years ago, you covered one of the worst days in nation's history, the assassination of President Kennedy.
Yeah.
More than 50 years later, though, many people believe, and perhaps rightfully, that we never really got the entire truth about the events of that day. And 2 days later, Oswald was killed. So is this post-truth era really news after Vietnam, Watergate, the Gulf of Tonkin, Iran-Contra, and November 22nd, 1963? Are we really getting all the truth back then, and are we getting it now?
Well, I think there will always be questions. I mean, I was there.
Yeah, you were.
I was there and covered that story, the assassination. I have always felt that had we been able to bring Lee Harvey Oswald to trial, that we would have had a better understanding and probably there wouldn't be nearly as many conspiracy theories about what really happened.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was one of the tragedies of that day. That is also the day that Americans, how they got the news changed. Up until that point, a majority of Americans got their news from newspapers. From that day forward, television became the dominant media where people mostly got their news. And it remains so today, although there's even greater competition. But, you know, I'll tell you, that day was the day America really lost its innocence, I always felt. And I'm not sure we've recovered from it since. We saw our presidents in those days as being somehow superhuman.
Mm-hmm.
People grew in the office. And then this total loser comes along who'd never accomplished anything in his life and killed the president of the United States.
Right.
And I think it changed our feelings about the presidency and about a lot of things. People have asked me since, do I think that Oswald did it and do I think he had any help? I think the Warren Commission sort of stumbled and bumbled around but came to the right conclusion as to whether there was somebody else involved somewhere, somehow. I still have an open mind about that, but to this point, I have seen no evidence that convinces me that he did get help. But there's no question, this guy was a cold-blooded killer. and he's the one who pulled the trigger.
Jack Ruby, though, what happened there? Do we know?
No. He was a guy who was always seeking approval. He was this, he owned a strip joint,
right,
and he hung around the police station and went and got him coffee because he needed their goodwill to keep operating. I think he thought that he was going to become some sort of national hero, especially to Mrs. Kennedy. And he talked about that. What he was a fool is mm-hmm. what he was. Did he have a connection to organized crime? I've seen no conclusive evidence that he did.
Now, this is certainly not the first president to try to steer news coverage to his advantage. That's been going on for a long time. But when he offers a tweet about NFL players kneeling and the media jumps on that story, is the media being distracted from health care, taxes, North Korea, and other important issues? I'm not saying the NFL story should not be covered at all, but did we overcover it? Are we being baited?
Well, when you look at the size of the audiences that professional football draws, it is a big part of American life and American culture. So I think you have to cover that story. Was it a distraction? I think yes. Mm-hmm. I think it was. Did he raise this issue because he was trying to create a distraction? I don't know. But this is how he got to the presidency. This was somebody that followed, whether he knew what he was doing or not, followed what we in politics call the dead cat theory. And that is, no matter what the conversation is, if you're having a dinner party at your home and somebody throws a dead cat in the middle of the table, it immediately shifts to the dead cat.
Right.
And you talk about that for a while. So all during the campaign, we saw him early morning tweets, early morning appearances on television. However the narration of the campaign, the conversation was going at the beginning of the morning, by noon, everybody was reacting to what he had said. He did this over and over again.
What can the media be doing better to get at the truth? We watch those White House press briefings. They're shown live now on most of the cable channels. It's a jousting match. It's a sword fight. Once it's over, is that enough? What should those White House reporters do once that's over, when they go back to their cubicle?
There's no campaign I've ever covered. There's no White House or Congress I've ever covered that we couldn't have done a better job.
Yeah.
This is a human endeavor. The White House briefings, I don't know why. There's no information coming out there. You do want to get an on-the-record answer to all of these issues. Mm-hmm. I think, you'd be better to send a kid with a clipboard to just write down what they said, because you're not going to find out any news that matters very much. One of the interesting things, thinking back to Watergate, Woodward and Bernstein never set foot in a White House briefing throughout the entire story.
It would have been a waste of time for them to do so.
Well, they didn't have time, and they did something entirely new. They went to people's homes at night and knocked on the door and said, "Hey, we're from the Washington Post. Will you talk to us?" And as always happens, if you knock on enough doors, somebody's going to talk to you. And, there was all this business at the beginning of the Trump administration. We may not have briefings. We may move them across the street. My response to that always was, okay, you tell us where you're going to do it and we'll show up. We don't need to be in some special place. And anybody who thinks that reducing the numbers of White House briefings is going to in any way cause the press to reduce its intensity in covering the news just doesn't know very much about reporters or how they go about their business.
Now, it's no secret newspapers are in trouble. The readership is down, circulation is down, advertising is down, but it still manages to show up on our front porch every morning. What's the future of the daily newspaper?
Well, newspapers are in a crisis, and they don't show up anymore on some front doors. We have lost 126 newspapers in the last 12 years. And here's a stat when I was writing my book that I was not aware of. In 2004, one reporter in eight lived in Washington, New York, or Los Angeles. That number is down now to one in five.
Hmm.
So there are many parts of this country where people are just no longer getting legitimate news, as I would call it. In other words, that news that's been vetted in the traditional way we've always vetted it. We don't publish something or we don't broadcast things unless we think it's true. And it's not a case in some of these places, especially in rural America up through the Rust Belt, that they're getting biased news. They're just not getting any news. And there's nobody there to report it. The newspapers in many towns that have survived are just a shell of what they once were. They don't have staff to do investigative reporting, things of that nature. The good news in all of this is that the Washington Post and the New York Times have found a way to totally reinvent themselves. And they're not just a newspaper company anymore. They're media companies. And they are putting their product on as many as 5 or 6 different platforms. In some months, the Washington Post, for example, will reach 70 million viewers. Now, the circulation of the paper newspaper is 400,000. But they're thriving. And for the last 2 years, the Post has been in the black. They hired 60 reporters this year. They have 7 White House correspondents now. They're doing great. Of course, they have what every newspaper wishes it had, and that is their own billionaire, Jeff Bezos, who bought the newspaper and told the guy that I consider to be the best newspaper editor in America, Marty Baron, who was at the Boston Globe before he came to the Post. He told Baron, you produce the best newspaper in America, and he has done what successful owners do. You know, he put up the money, and he told him he wanted it to be a business, not a charity. And so far, so good. And I think there are a lot of things that other newspapers can learn from the way the Post and the Times are going about their business these days.
The future of TV news, the 30-minute newscast at 6:30 or 7 from the network, that remains the flagship broadcast of the day. Where is that going?
We don't know. We get, like at CBS, 5 or 6 million people every night that sit down and watch the news. And my boss, David Rhodes, says as long as we can attract a crowd of that size, we're going to keep doing it. But more and more, the focus now, CBS has reinvented itself. Mm-hmm. The evening news no longer drives the boat. They used to make all the money, and they used to drive it. Now, emphasis is shifting more and more to the morning news broadcast. 2 hours. It's the last time slot where you can tell people something maybe they didn't know. And so I think for that reason, I think they have a really great future. But, you know, at CBS, we have also started this online streaming service. It goes to your computer or your phone called CBSN. It's all news all the time. And there were times during the presidential nominating conventions in 2016 where there would be times when we'd get a larger audience there than we were getting on the network. So I really think that's where the future of television news is right now.
Your book is Overload, Finding the Truth in Today's Deluge of News. You use the word deluge. Yeah, I saw one interview you called it like we're being hit with a fire hose.
Yeah, well, I mean, the news is just, it is. It's like trying to drink out of a fire hose now to try to get this stuff. And it's coming in from everywhere, 24/7. And it's literally more than any human being could possibly process. Walt Mossberg, who wrote the technology column, first he wrote a foreign policy column for the Wall Street Journal, later on technology. He said, you know, when you're in the middle of something, you don't really realize all the ramifications of it. And we are right now. I mean, I argue in this book that the coming of the internet is having a greater impact on our culture than the invention of the printing press did on the people of that day. And, you know, we all know of the great advantages that the printing press brought us. Literacy improved. You know, we had the Reformation, the Counter-Reformation. But what we sometimes forget is it was also followed by 30 years of religious war, and it was 3 decades before Europe sort of settled into some sort of equilibrium. We're not there yet. We're kind of what I think is probably the first trimester of this thing. I think in the end, we'll be strengthened by the advantages that the technology brings, But it's going to be a bumpy ride until we get to equilibrium.
Well, I wish I could spend the next 3 hours with Bob Schieffer, but he's a busy man. He's in Albany today for Telling the Truth in a Post-Truth World, which is being held at the University at Albany. Bob Schieffer's new book, Overload, Finding Truth in Today's Deluge of News. Bob Schieffer, it's an honor and a pleasure to speak with you today.
Well, I certainly appreciate you having me, and I had fun talking to you.
Thank you very much.